From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. It's our Christmas special. Coming up, we'll hear a couple of stories about Christmas that I have produced and voiced over the last couple of decades. I hope you really enjoy them. And then we'll delve into some history. In fact, we'll hear the story of corn as it was developed in the United States right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Happy holidays. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. From my family to yours, wishing you the very merriest of Christmases. It's that time of year when we consider just how important our family is to us. I hope that yours means as much to you as mine does to me. Also, that my family extends all the way to you from right here on this campus. I oftentimes think of WILL, the radio station, U of I Extension, the College of Agriculture, and all the folks that I travel with each and every year, bringing you news and information about agriculture as part of my family. I hope that makes a difference to you and that it helps you in your family affairs as well, because I'm assuming if you listen to the show more often than not, you're probably a farmer if you're listening really deeply to the show, maybe a landowner, or maybe you're just interested in agriculture. However that happens, thank you for listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It does mean so much to me. Have a great Christmas break. Coming up next, I'll tell you a few stories. That's what my mother-in-law says I do for a living, and sometimes, really, I do. What I want from Santa this year is a toy tractor. Well, Santa actually already brought it to me. He made it himself. It's a Meadow Green Oliver, 1955, trimmed in clover white with orange and black to set it off. And this little toy tractor is the first model he's ever made with a radio mounted right there on the fender. It's just like the one I clung to as a little boy when Dad and I went to the field. My Santa is Joe Ertle of Dyersville, Iowa. For 50 years, the company his dad founded has made the dreams of little and big farm boys come true.
Now I'm only 5 years old. I've got to do just what I'm told. 'Cause Santa Claus is going to be dropping in on me.
Max Armstrong, farm broadcaster, WGN, U.S. Farm Report, Chicago. Every kid loves a tractor. There's no doubt in my mind, boys love tractors. And as we get a little bit older, some of us who grew up on those tractors think back to those days. I mean, when I look at my Farmall Super M or the Super H, I think about days of sitting in that tractor, bringing in a load of corn when I was a little boy, and coming in on a chilly October night with that moon coming up over the corn stalks. Or I think about cultivating corn down to the Wabash Bottoms. I was on one tractor and Dad was on another. You know, there's just something very, very special. Especially if it's a tractor that Dad had. You know, there's an emotion that gets wrapped up in that.
It is an emotion that Max Armstrong knows all too well, and one that has made Joseph Ertle's toy tractors worth a lot of money. At this auction in November, to benefit scholarships for future farm broadcasters, Max spent $300 on a 1/8-inch scale Farmall MD. It's special for many reasons.
That's an M diesel. And this one is special because it's a 50th anniversary tractor. On the frame of that tractor are raised letters pointing out that it's the 50th year of toy making for Joseph Ertle, the legendary toy maker who owns Scale Model Toys.
Would you like me to put anything up here on the your name or anything?
Joe Ertle is a celebrity in his own right, and for years his autograph has been sought after. Like Santa, he gives it
freely.
Can you write, thanks for support of Farm Broadcasting?
I'll date it there for you too. And
you've done this before.
Yeah, a few thousand times.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
your
help.
You're welcome. Thank you for supporting.
Well, it started way back in 1945 when my father was on strike at a local foundry. And he started making castings in his basement. And one day he made a farm toy, and I was 10 years old at the time. And at that time, the toy tractor sold so well, he never went back to his job again. And of course, I grew up with the business. And then when I was in my senior year of high school, I started taking drafting courses. And we went from sand casting to die casting. And we had to have drawings, so I started making the drawings for the toys, and I've been designing them ever since.
Today, Joe Ertl's company is called Scale Models, and he still loves to design and make toy tractors, in large part, he says, because the farm community has welcomed him into its vast family called agriculture.
It's been a pleasure for me to work my whole life here in the designing of these toys, which have made so many people happy. You know, the farmers have really been great to our family, and I can't think of anything more wholesome than little toy tractor and to be a pretend a farmer. It's so much better than some of these toys I've seen made over the year, and it's been a pleasure for me to be associated with the farmers and the farming industry and everything. It's just been a wonderful life.
What's that?
That's a Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
If you're lucky, what you'll find under your Christmas tree this year is a toy tractor made by Joseph Ertl in Dyersville, Iowa. That's what's on the top of my list. Well, by the way, thanks in advance, Santa. Your friend, Todd Gleason at the University of Illinois.
There could be something I might have missed. I had quite a few things on my list. I hope he can fit it all under that Christmas tree. Hope he can fit it all under my Christmas tree. Let's see, I know he's gonna fit the, he'll fit the airplane under there, and he can get that bicycle in there and the gumball machine. And I don't know what he's gonna do with that horse.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. That last story, by the way, I produced more than a decade ago. Hey, do visit our website. The address there is willag.org. That's willag.org. There we post all of our agricultural programming, and you'll find a way to contact me, but you can do it this way, too. If you want to call me, you can do 217-333-9697. That's 217-333-9697. My email address is tgleason@illinois.edu. That's T-G-L-E-A-S-O-N at Illinois, spelled out, .edu. The EDU, of course, stands for education. If you're interested in having us come out and do one of our Will Ag panels at an evening or daytime event, we'll be glad to do that. You can call us up and we can talk a bit about having some of the analysts that you hear on the air come out to your event. Now, up next, another story for Christmas.
The Night Before Christmas, a poem by Clement Moore. "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mom in her kerchief and I in my cap, well, we'd just settled down for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn, there rose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter, and away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw open the sash, and the moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave a luster of midday to the objects below, when what to my wondering eye should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all, as dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mounted the sky, so up to the house of the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he'd flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth, it was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin, well, that was as white as snow. The stump of the pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye, a twist of his head, soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings. And then he turned with a jerk, and laying his finger beside his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team, gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down on a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. I thought it might be interesting to think about the history of corn. About 15 years ago, I spoke with a retired corn breeder, his name was Forrest Troyer, about the history of corn. He'd gone through and taken a look at where corn came from. The hybrids that are used, even still today, have their genetic ancestry linked to just a few varieties of corn. Troyer spent about 7 years researching and writing about his favorite crop. We'll explore where corn came from today and how it was domesticated right here in the United States. Corn was first domesticated in Mexico between 4,500 and 7,000 years ago along the 18th parallel. It was flint corn. Somewhere around 1,000 BC, retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer says this early corn was moved into the area we now know as New Mexico and Arizona.
And then the dent corn came in after Columbus, probably Cortez, when he went to Tampa Bay, when he went to Tampa Bay, probably brought the first dent corn to the United States.
The critical thing about these two moves was that the corn, flint and dent, had to be adapted to longer days and cooler, shorter seasons. Now, dent has also been developed in Mexico, but much later than flint, probably about 1500 BC, says Troyer. So flint corn came into the southwestern part of the United States, and dent corn traveled much later into the eastern U.S. Dent corn was superior to flint in almost every respect. The kernels were larger and the yields were greater. Soon enough, European settlers in the New World recognized the two different kinds of corn were related and could be crossed.
And the flints were the source of earlier maturity that was needed, and the dents were the source of higher yield and also better feeding traits. So some number of people in Virginia and in Tennessee and Kentucky crossed flint by dents to develop varieties.
Generally, says Troyer, it is estimated that by the time most of the United States had been settled, in the 1840s, about 250 different varieties of Dent/Flint crosses had been developed. The Corn Belt, at that time, still hadn't made its way northward. The prime growing states were Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
And the reason for that is that the land grants from the Revolutionary War from Virginia, the state of Virginia, and also the land grants that were issued to veterans of the Mexican War were virtually all in that area. There was a small area in southern Ohio on the Scioto River, but there were two areas in Tennessee and there's two areas in Kentucky. And of course, the corn in Virginia was already there. I mean, you know that they had already worked with it before the movement west started.
It is the combination of what American Indians did in bringing Flint corn north into the U.S. and what European settlers did with Dent corn on the East Coast that has resulted in the hybrids grown today by farmers in the new Corn Belt: Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. As farmers settled those states, they brought the 250 Dent-Flint crosses northwestward with them. 40 years later, in the 1880s, these producers had adapted the 250 varieties to the local conditions in the states across the Midwest. It resulted in 1,000 locally adapted open-pollinated varieties of corn. In 1888, Iowa, for the first time ever, raised more corn than any other state in the Union. The extra 750 varieties of open-pollinated corn, says retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer, were more drought-tolerant and shorter-seasoned than the original 250.
Out of those 1,000 varieties, I don't know the exact number, but there were probably 20 or 30 varieties that were grown much more than the others. One thing that contributed to that was the corn shows.
One of the most popular varieties was called Limming. It was developed about 40 or 50 miles northeast of Cincinnati, Ohio, in Wilmington, and had won a corn show in Paris, France. It was the first widely adapted variety of yellow corn. Half of all the yellow corn grown in the U.S. was at one time Limming corn. It actually represented just one quarter of the total U.S. corn crop, because 50% of the corn grown in the mid-1800s was white Dent corn, not yellow Dent corn. Well, the next big variety was to become the foundation of almost all of today's hybrid corn. It was called Reed's Yellow Dent. Troyer says Robert Reed developed the variety by accident when he moved from Russellville, Ohio to Delavan, Illinois. In that first year, he planted and saved back seed from a variety called Gordon Hopkins corn. It had been planted late in the season. The following spring, he planted the Gordon Hopkins corn again.
He didn't run a germination test, and he got a field of corn where the stand was too good to tear up, but it wasn't as good as it should be. So he went in and he hand-planted what they called a common early yellow Flint that was grown in the area. And because the early corn was planted later, they crossed. And then over a period of at least 40 years, Robert Reed and then later James Reed selected Reed's Yellow Dent.
It became very popular after winning the corn show at the Chicago Columbian Exposition. Troyer says because of the win, farmers oftentimes called Reed's Yellow Dent World's Fair corn. A Perry Holden, head of the agronomy department at the University of Illinois, evangelized Reed's Yellow Dent, and he convinced the Funk brothers of Bloomington, Illinois to start producing and selling Reed's Yellow Dent. Holden later took a position at Iowa State University and took 600 bushels of Reed's Yellow Dent with him. Troyer says some Iowa seedsmen were not very happy about the introduction of an Illinois corn in their state.
It soon replaced a lot of the varieties that were formerly in Iowa.
Reed's Yellow Dent and livestock feeding trial studies from the University of Wisconsin and Purdue are the major reasons U.S. corn farmers abandoned white corn. By the way, most of the 1,000 original pollinated varieties developed and grown in the Midwest were white corn. The university studies proved pigs grew faster when they ate yellow corn. It was because yellow corn provided a good source of vitamin A, and white corn did not. A Reed's Yellow Dent was the most popular open-pollinated corn variety in states like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa. But the farther north you went, the less tolerant it was of the shorter, drier growing season. Well, the University of Minnesota went to work on the problem and solved it with a yellow-dent corn called Minnesota 13. These two varieties, says Forrest Troyer, set the stage for the development of hybrid corn. By 1920, the double-cross hybrid method had been developed by Donald Jones. Still, it remained difficult to find four inbreds good enough to make a double-cross to sell. Henry Wallace, who founded the Pioneer Seed Company in Iowa, sold the first double-cross hybrid in 1924. It was called Copper Cross. It wasn't until 10 years later, in 1934, that hybrid corn varieties even made a dent in U.S. corn production. Forrest Troyer says that year, 0.3% of all corn sold for seed in the U.S. was a hybrid.
And Iowa was the fastest growing, partly because of the work that the editorials that Henry Wallace wrote for Wallace's Farmer. And by World War II, by 1941, 1942, I believe 90% of the corn in Iowa was hybrid, and the rest of the Corn Belt wasn't far behind, just a few more years, you know, that they, it was an amazing thing once it got going. It was quickly accepted.
In 1934, that 0.3% of hybrid seed sold in the U.S. came primarily from two companies, Pioneer and the Funk Brothers Seed Company of Bloomington, Illinois. In 1935, Troyer says the first Ag Experiment Station hybrid was introduced, U.S. 13. A year later, Iowa 939 was released. In those early years of hybridization of corn, it was thought farmers would buy the original material and then produce their own hybrids. That's how open-pollinated crosses had been adapted throughout the Midwest, but the model didn't work for hybrid corn. So the corn seed companies prospered. Pioneer and Funk, along with DeKalb, were the three largest. These three companies and the experiment stations used the available open-cross yellow-dent corn to develop their hybrids. It was at this point that the majority of the genetic diversification of the domesticated corn plant was lost. Today's hybrid corn comes from about 8 genetically different open-pollinated yellow-dent corn lines. They include Lemming, Lancaster, Reed's Yellow Dent, Minnesota 13, Northwestern Dent, Funk's Yellow Dent, and Troyer's Reed, along with 176A.
But over time, the thing that happened is that those inbreds that came from those popular varieties became the backbone of the hybrid seed corn industry. And what it really amounted to, as more emphasis was put on wide adaptation of the hybrids, the inbreds from the varieties that did well over a more widely adapted area came to the forefront, and they're the backbone of the hybrid seed corn industry today.
Forrest Troyer traced half of the seed corn sold today to Reed's Yellow Dent, another 20% directly to Lemming, Lancaster, Minnesota 13, and Northwestern Dent. It's a narrow genetic base from which to work, and before his death in May of 2015, said this confines the ability of corn breeders to continue improving yellow dent corn. During his professional career, Forrest Troyer developed or co-developed 40 commercial corn hybrids that sold more than 60 million bags of seed in North America. This is enough corn to plant all North American production for 2 years. His most well-known corn hybrids from 1974 to 1983 were Pioneer hybrids 3732 and 3780. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.